I'm Leonard Lopate, and you're listening to a repeat broadcast of The Leonard Lopate Show. In his book, The Sword and the Shield, Christopher Andrew focused on the covert activities of the KGB in the Western world, including North America and Europe. His latest, The World Was Going Our Way, The KGB and the Battle for the Third World, covers a very different chapter of Soviet espionage history. It's published by Basic Books. Christopher Andrew, who is a professor of modern and contemporary history at Cambridge University, joins me now. Welcome to my show.
Thanks very much.
Why did you decide to focus on Soviet operations in developing countries? In the overall history of the KGB, how significant was that effort?
Well, the way that Vasily Matrokhin, the extraordinary dissident archivist who got all this stuff to the West with just a little bit of help from British intelligence, the way that we decided to do it is that first volume would be about operations in Europe and the West, and the second volume would be in the developing world. How significant? Very significant, because in the end, what the KGB decided was that where it could beat the United States was not in the United States. It was going to be in the developing world, where the United States was becoming terribly unpopular.
And although all the spy novels focus on the first conflict, the fact of the matter is the KGB was doing very well throughout the rest of the world. Not doing all that well in Britain or France or Germany or the United States, but very, very well in most of the Third World.
Well, it was doing decliningly well in Britain. Of course, the great hidden hurt of Cambridge University is that, unlike your university, Leonard, Cambridge has sent intelligence officers into both sides, not just in our side.
But that ended in the mid-50s.
It ended in the mid-50s, but nonetheless, the KGB always considered the ablest group of agents that it ever recruited, five from Cambridge, who, when that wonderful Western, The Magnificent Seven, came out, The Magnificent Five. But you're right. By the mid-1950s, these people are either gone or not achieving anything. And then they have this divine surprise. I mean, the idea that a young, charismatic, good-looking, third-world revolutionary, he don't look like that now, but that's precisely what Fidel Castro used to look like, instead of aligning with the new left, would align himself with Leonid Brezhnev, which is about as old as you could get. The other thing that the KGB really loved is that he preferred dealing with them to diplomats. So the Soviet diplomat that was sent over to become the first ambassador to Castro's Cuba, he got rid of, and he had him replaced by the local KGB station chief, the resident, and they became firm friends.
The early 60s were also a time of independence movements around the world, and the KGB, well, it had already been accused of meddling in Iran's affairs, and then was accused of trying to kill Lumumba and get involved in some other political matters. Did that also help the KGB?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the great difference, particularly in the 1970s, was that the American intelligence community, CIA in particular, was being investigated in public by investigative journalists and by the Church Committee and other official commissions in a way that no other intelligence community had ever been investigated before.
But that's because of its failures.
Absolutely. But on the other hand, there were bigger failures in the Soviet Union, but just this little difficulty, they didn't have a single investigative journalist and it didn't have a single investigator in official commission. So, you know, the pickings are easy, and particularly, you know, it's difficult now to remember that in the mid-1970s, and indeed considerably later, a majority of Americans believe that the CIA had killed JFK. So when in the Third World, the KGB goes up to leaders and says, look at this stuff that's coming out in Washington. And yet even Americans realize that JFK was killed by the CIA. You think that they're bothered about killing you? Of course they wouldn't be.
Let's talk a bit about Vasily Matrokhin. You say he was the dissident archivist. He was an archivist for the KGB. And how much information did he have available to him?
Well, I mean, it sounds like an exaggeration, but it actually isn't. He had available to him all the information for foreign intelligence. And here's why.
You mean from the founding of the KGB on?
Yeah. I mean, he had to choose which he preferred to note, and he was more interested in post-World War II stuff than pre-World War II stuff, but he did note some pretty seamy stuff about Cambridge University in the 1930s, for example. But he was the guy who was given the job of overseeing the move of the entire Foreign Intelligence Archive from its nasty, cramped headquarters in the Lubyanka, which is still where President Putin has his internal security service, to a nice new building just beyond the Moscow Ring Road. Took 10 years. Very bureaucratic system. He had to sign it all out at one end. He had to sign it all in at the other end. Now, how can we tell that he had access to just about everything that mattered? Because he had access to the Holy of Holies. And the Holy of Holies is easy to identify. These are the files of the so-called illegals. People who, instead of looking Russian, look like you or me, have jobs, let's say, as academics or as hosts. And fool people.
Are you suggesting something about me?
No, I was casting suspicion on myself rather than you. But anyway, if you get hold of those files, which give the real names of these guys, none of them I can exclusively reveal working for this organization. Their cover stories, dates of birth, and so on. If you can get to see that, there ain't nothing you can't get to see.
So he knew from the start that he was going to do something with this? Or did he just copy the things that he found interesting for his own amusement?
It wasn't for his own amusement. He wanted to use it, but he didn't know how he was going to do it to expose the KGB, but for motivation. You know, all of us have complex motivations. But here's a simple rule of thumb. If you're prepared to put your life on the line day after day after day for something you're doing, you don't have to doubt the guy's motivation. So any day that had been caught, what would have happened? Simple. There'd have been a secret trial. He'd have been found guilty, sentenced to death, quick walk to the execution cellar, a bullet in the back of the head, and we'd never have heard of him again. But how he was going to get this stuff out, he didn't know. And then, you know, he didn't foresee any more than anybody else foresaw the moment at which the Soviet Union was going to fall apart. And then he was able to get by an overnight train, looking like a vagrant. He wished to look like a vagrant in order not to attract suspicion. He walks up with his battered case on wheels. He goes into the British embassy. You know, the young diplomat, seeing this vagrant saying he had top secret stuff from the KGB, could easily have said, "On your way." But she didn't. She asked a question which I believe only a British diplomat could ask and which changed his life and sort of changed mine. Would you like a cup of tea? And while he was having his first ever cup of tea, he passed over some of the samples beneath the spiced sausages and the dirty underwear and the other stuff that he had put to discourage people ferreting into it. And she saw this stuff about the illegals.
She knew
if that checked out, this must be kosher.
He'd still be considered a traitor today in Russia, wouldn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, he died early last year, but there is, I'm sure, no doubt, that he was under sentence of death when he did so. I mean, the other most celebrated defector to Britain over the last 20 years, Oleg Gordievsky, he is still under sentence of death. There's been no suggestion that it should be commuted, despite the fact that the Cold War is at an end.
Until you gained access to this material, did you have a very different view of how the KGB had worked and what its successes were and its failures? Or did you have an inkling that got at least amplified by these documents?
Well, it wasn't so much that I had a different view. I was just ignorant. You know, I had the same books as everybody else. Now, if you pick up a book on the Cold War, you know, whatever it is, and there's some very good ones, just look at the index. The CIA is always in there. I mean, nobody's going to write a history of the Cold War which doesn't have the Bay of Pigs, which doesn't have Nixon telling the CIA to make the economy scream in A&E's chili. Now, the KGB was up to even more. Here's the difference that I think it makes. I mean, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that when it comes to the secret Cold War, what we get from existing histories of the Cold War, many excellent ones, is the sound of one hand clapping. The secret Cold War is the sound of both hands clapping. Well, I'd like to think that, you know, Vasily Mitrokhin and I have gone some way to turning the secret history of the Cold War into two hands clapping.
And I am talking to Christopher Andrew, who with Vasily Mitrokhin is the author of The World Was Going Our Way, The KGB and the Battle for the Third World. It is published by Basic Books. Were some countries more willing to work with the KGB than others? Where were they particularly successful?
Well, the irony is that the more democratic a country was, the easier it was to penetrate. The places that they found most difficult to penetrate were other one-party states, in particular communist one-party states. So let's take Asia. You know, during the Vietnam War, the public perception was that the Soviet Union and North Vietnam as it was, United Vietnam as it became, were absolutely the closest of buddies, and indeed the Russians were providing with the majority of their arms. But you know, the KGB operated in Hanoi in the same way that it operated against hostile targets. The most senior agent identified by the stuff that Matrokhin copied out from the archives is somebody that they recruited, senior intelligence officer, Vietnamese intelligence officer they recruited in Moscow. He wouldn't work for them in Vietnam. He was too scared that he was going to be caught. Now, let's take democratic India. You know, a billion people, an open society with a streak of corruption running through its media and political system. So the irony was democratic India was an easier target than communist Vietnam with whom they were allied.
And you point out that late in the KGB's history, pretty much at the end, it can't get through to Saddam Hussein.
It can't get through to Saddam Hussein. I mean, its problem in the Middle East was that it kept thinking it had found a solid ally. I mean, the most remarkable of all is, remember, that the Soviet Union was just about the first to recognize the State of Israel. I mean, they thought all these Eastern European Jews moving to Israel would be sufficiently grateful for what the Red Army had done to turn Israel into a thought in the imperialist side. Well, they gave that up pretty quickly. Then they thought they could do a deal with Nasser in Egypt. And
then they started criticizing the Zionists,
as
they call
them. That's it. And there was a point when they hoped they could do a deal with Saddam Hussein. They had a pretty good idea of how to sort of make him feel good about the Soviet relationship. When people used to wander into Saddam Hussein's deeply unsavory headquarters in the early 1970s, a couple of things they would have noticed would have been quite a number of boxes of Johnny Walker whiskey hanging about, and the other would have been a lot of biographies, most of them translated, of Joseph Stalin. You know, Joseph Stalin and Saddam Hussein really deserved each other. One could see how he would take him as kind of role model. So the KGB thought that they could get him to be friendly by taking him on secret trips around the Black Sea, looking at all the dachas that Stalin had spent his holidays in. But anyone who thinks he can do a deal with Saddam Hussein is mistaken. And so in the end, they end up with Assad, Syria. I'm not talking about the current Assad, but the previous Assad, and oh boy, anybody who was reduced to doing a deal with Assad, Syria, really shows they were up, you know, they're really out of luck in the Middle East.
But they did try to give Saddam some information about the Gulf War that George Bush the father was planning, and he didn't want to listen.
No, but you see, that is actually something which Saddam Hussein shared with Joseph Stalin. These were smart people, but they were conspiracy theorists. If you told Stalin there wasn't a conspiracy, he knew that there was. But if you told him there was a conspiracy, he knew that wasn't a real conspiracy. So when he had warning after warning that Hitler was about to attack, he knew that this was a conspiracy to make him think Hitler was going to attack. And what happens in the case of Saddam Hussein is that when he is told that, Soviet satellite intelligence and others show it's not going to be a frontal amphibious attack through Kuwait. It's going to be a left hook, or was it a right hook? Depends which way you're coming from. He knew that there was a plot to deceive him.
My guest is Christopher Andrew, professor of modern and contemporary history at Cambridge University, former visiting professor of national security at Harvard, and a guest lecturer at numerous American universities and at the CIA. His writings, including Her Majesty's Secret Service, KGB, and For the President's Eyes Only, Secret Intelligence and the American Presidency, have established him as one of the authorities on intelligence. His latest book is The World Was Going Our Way, The KGB and the Battle for the Third World, written with the help of archivist Vasily Matrokhin. It is published by Basic Books, and we will continue after this. We're back with Professor Christopher Andrew of Cambridge University. His latest book, The World Was Going Our Way, The KGB and the Battle for the Third World, written with the help of Vasily Mitrokhin and the archives that he smuggled out of the Soviet Union. The book is published by Basic Books. You mentioned that India was an easy country for the KGB to infiltrate. What did they get out of it?
It's an extremely good question, and it's really quite difficult to tell, because influencing people is something which is pretty difficult to measure. But what they got out of it was a tremendous reputation in the Kremlin, because they could say X, Y, and Z, you know, for the Congress Party and other parties. They've accepted campaign funds from us. How much good it did them is another matter. They were able to say that the Communist Party was accepting money for its campaign funds as well. Now, here's the tricky bit, but let me give you a few examples. Quite a lot of the things that India believed, it believed, or the Indian government believed, it believed without any help from the KGB. You know, it was critical of the United States in all kinds of ways, but it might have been anyway. But there were certain kinds of criticisms of the CIA in particular, which is difficult to believe would have happened without some influence operations. Let me just give one example. You know, the idea which got tremendous publicity in India in the mid-1980s that AIDS was actually American biological warfare which had gone wrong, Fort Detrick in Maryland. I don't believe that that would have cropped up naturally in India. And time after time...
It was very big in Africa as well.
Very big in Africa as well. But actually the story spread out from India 1984 onwards. And when Indira Gandhi, she didn't usually name the United States, but she kept talking about hidden hand, hidden forces, people behind unrest in Assam, Northeast, Punjab, and so on. Rajiv Gandhi in 1982, actually deliberately accused not an unseen hand, but the United States and the CIA in particular. And then again, you know, Indira Gandhi's belief that she was under threat from an assassination plot, you know, after Allende was killed, you know, CIA was up to no good in Chile, but it didn't actually kill Allende. Her saying, you know, when they kill me, they will say that I killed myself. She was plainly referring to Allende. Of course, the tragedy was that she was far more aware of the mythical threat to her from the CIA than she was of the real threat to her by her Sikh bodyguards, who did in the end kill her.
And they had more reason, since she had attacked their holiest place.
The Golden
place.
Temple, absolutely.
Now, whenever there was a right-wing totalitarian or authoritarian state in need of justifying itself, it said there's a communist threat. We saw that in Chile with Pinochet. We saw that in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Was the KGB... involved in Chile after the fall of Allende? Did they have any real say as to ANC policy in South Africa?
Well, let's take Chile first. You know, both the CIA and the KGB were attempting to influence the presidential election in Chile in 1970. It's simply the KGB did rather a better job. The problem for the CIA, I mean, neither side should have been attempting to influence the election. Let's be perfectly clear about that. But the CIA was under certain restrictions. It wasn't allowed to use its money to support any particular candidate. All it was able to do was spend its money to try and stop Allende being elected. But as you know, somebody in the CIA said, how do you beat somebody with nobody? Now, the KGB's money was precisely focused on Allende. One wouldn't have thought that it would make too much of a difference. But you know, when we remember that Allende got in by the slimmest of pluralities, 30 or 40,000 votes. The KGB claimed that they prevented through money some absolute no-hoper standing who might have taken that amount of votes off him. So, you know, maybe they did have an influence. Otherwise, Allende is like Castro to this extent. He actually prefers dealing with the local KGB chief to the diplomat, and the diplomat gets very upset. So what the book documents is Allende's very close dealings throughout his period as president with the KGB chief.
But he wasn't willing to move his country into the communist camp the way Castro had.
Well, what the KGB complains about in the end is that they're not paying enough attention. They're saying, look, there are these right-wing plots. They're going to get you. And then they're complaining to Moscow. He's not paying any attention. In the end, they sort of pull the plug on him. They have a long debate as to whether to give him a lot more money, try and prod up the regime. They conclude he's a goner anyway. We'll let him go.
Did they have any success in Africa?
Well, if there's one place, I think, where arguably the KGB actually did some good, not a huge amount of good, it's in Africa. You know, the ANC cannot be blamed for a point when the West was scared to support it. That's certainly true of Britain, certainly true of the United States. At a point when, you know, they have very little support around the world, some Russian money just helps to keep them going. And that, I think, is the only area that I can think of where the KGB arguably had a positive influence on world affairs.
My guest is Christopher Andrew. His book, The World Was Going Our Way, The KGB and the Battle for the Third World, written with the help of Vasily Mitrokhin and the archives he smuggled out of Russia. The book is published by Basic Books. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. How much of a role did the KGB play in the invasion of Afghanistan and everything that's followed since?
Well, it plays an absolutely central role, but the foreign ministry was never really, in particular under Gromyko, was foreign minister just about as long as anyone has ever been foreign minister in the 20th century. He aren't really interested in the Third World, so it was basically left to the KGB. And at every stage in the forward policy, from doing a deal with Castro up to the war in Afghanistan, it's the KGB which is in the lead. So the war in Afghanistan is impossible without killing the incumbent president, Hafez al-Amin. Why? Because Hafez al-Amin ain't going to invite the Soviet troops in. He's going to protest he's invaded. So you've got to assassinate him. They tried poisoning his food. That didn't work. And then they send him to the KGB special forces shortly after Christmas, 1979, and they kill him. And then there's a puppet president installed instead. So it's not just the KGB, but impossible without the KGB.
Well, we've talked a lot about the blowback from American support of the Mujahideen in fighting the Soviets. What is the legacy of the KGB's role in Afghanistan, and does it continue to play a part? Is it linked at all to some of the people we call terrorists?
Well, you use the word blowback, and here's an example of blowback. In the 1990s, they're spreading the story that Osama bin Laden had actually been a close CIA ally in the mid-1980s. And that it was actually he who suggested the use of the handheld, or at any rate shoulder-held missiles, the Stingers, which arguably changed the war in 1986-1987. Now, Yevgeny Primakov, who is Yeltsin's first head for about 5 years of Russian foreign intelligence, even in his memoirs produces this story. Now, what I think happened, can't prove it, is that Russian intelligence has been spreading this absurd myth. And somebody, one of their agents, had picked it up, not realizing that it actually came from a Russian source. And so that was blowback.
It seems to me that what you're saying is the KGB was a lot more effective than any other aspect of the Soviet institutions. The military didn't do as well. Obviously, the economists weren't doing as well. But the KGB, if they had only had a better government in place, perhaps could have been a giant success story.
Well, I mean, some of them continue to whinge nowadays that, you know, we were the best in the world. It's simply that there was political failure which took our success away from us. But, you know, they have changed in all kinds of ways, despite the whinging considerably. I mean, I think the most startling photographs that are produced in the book are of the KGB. Well, nowadays it's the FSB church. I mean, the one thing that could get you thrown out the same day was religious practice while the KGB was around. Nowadays, the FSB, the successor organization, has something the CIA doesn't have and will never have, something the British MI6 doesn't have and will never have. It has its own church in the center of Moscow, ministering to the neglected spiritual needs of its flock, opened by the patriarch, the Russian patriarch, Alexei II, with the head of intelligence there.
You mentioned earlier that Stalin was the first to recognize Israel. But Stalin had a long history of anti-Semitism, the doctor's plots and the like. And if we go back even further, Russia is where the Protocols of the Elders of Zion was fabricated. They worked an awful lot in anti-Zionist intelligence. They talked a lot about Zionist subversion, didn't they? How effective was that?
Well, I think the thing one needs to remember about any one-party state, any nasty dictator, all dictators are nasty, whether of right or left, when things don't go their way, they need a fall guy. They need a conspiracy theory. And you're absolutely right. Joseph Stalin had these extraordinary conspiracy theories. I mean, you know, he spent the last 6 months of his life believing that Jewish doctors were out to kill him, which is, of course, why he had his final long overdue seizure. No doctor dared to go near him for a few hours for fear that they would be blamed for his death. But this continues through the 60s, through the 70s, the first half of the 80s, as Brezhnev, in one of his few lucid moments, says, Zionism is driving us mad. I mean, they're even capable of regarding matzos being sent for Seder, for Passover in New York, from New York, rather, to the refuseniks in Russia, as ideological subversion. But there is this link also, a long-term link. I mean, the most outrageous and most influential and the most hateful conspiracy theory of the last century has been the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a Tsarist anti-Semitic forgery, which is praised in Hitler's Mein Kampf more than any other book he didn't write. And alas, on many Islamist, not Islamic, Islamist websites, you can find not merely quotations from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, you can find the complete text in a number of languages, and, oh, by the way, it's in Hamas's constitution as well.
Now, the KGB ended kind of with the end of the Soviet Union, but it was quickly replaced by an organization that looks very much like the KGB. So how much has really changed? Is the new version given up its efforts in developing nations?
Well, there's some interesting parallels, but I take a reasonably optimistic view about the whole thing. But, you know, the new Russian ambassador to India last year, Trubnikov, he was last there as head of political intelligence 20 years before. So continuities. The main continuity between the old and the new is the sheer political influence of intelligence officers. Yeltsin's last three prime ministers were all senior intelligence officers, and the last one of those, Vladimir Putin, is now president, and he is surrounded by more intelligence officers, past and present, than any other world leader. But why the game has changed is that, you know, since the end of the Cold War, counterterrorism has become much more important than counterespionage. East and West, Russia and the United States still spy on each other, but they cooperate in counterterrorism. And then, you know, as I was saying when talking about the FSB church, the FSB nowadays claims to be defending spiritual values. Look, the last head of public relations, he did, I kid you not, spiritual poetry and songs. He brought out a CD, which I doubt you'll ever play, which included items on it like a candle for me, mama. They don't do that at the CIA. They don't do that at MI6.
I'm sure that one of the problems the KGB faced at the end was the obvious failures of the Soviet Union. It was falling apart at the time. So how much did the collapse of the Soviet economy play into what the KGB was trying to convince other countries to do?
It simply undermined the whole thing.
Would they have succeeded otherwise, do you think?
Well, they say so, but I don't think so, because after all, the KGB is an expression of the Soviet system. If you hadn't had a Soviet system, you wouldn't have the KGB in the first place. But what is very interesting, I think, is to see how the KGB reacts when the whole thing is falling. They fall back on these old conspiracy theories. So I was in Moscow at the time, couldn't believe it. I'd already read the classified document, which was got out by another defector. December 1990, now 8 months before the Soviet Union begins to fall apart, they are claiming that their grain problems are due to the fact that the CIA has infected grain supplies. You know, a couple of months later, they're claiming that the CIA is undermining the ruble, you know, as if there was anything the CIA could do to undermine the ruble they weren't already doing. And then as it gets really serious, you know, it's the CIA spreading subversion here, there, and everywhere. So the KGB was in denial about why the system was failing. And the old boys, you know, it was not an equal opportunity employer, so there are hardly any old girls. The old boys, as they look back on it, are still in denial.
By giving the CIA all that power, they were making it into a much more effective organization than it really was.
Well, they were doing its public relations no harm at all.
And at the same time, they couldn't brag about their own successes because that would have suggested that, well, first of all, it would have undermined a lot of diplomatic efforts, but it also would have suggested that those claims about the CIA were not really true.
That is precisely the case. So the great problem the KGB had then and its successors have now is coming to terms with their past. You know, I think they're in the present, there are ways we can do business with them. The one thing that they've been completely unable to do is come to terms with their past record.
I wonder whether someone is reading a translation of your book as we speak.
These are smart people. I just would like to say thank you, guys, to all those FSB stations, actually SVR, Foreign Intelligence, that are buying multiple copies of this book at the present moment. Your custom is appreciated.
The author of this book is Christopher Andrews, a professor of modern and contemporary history at Cambridge University. He wrote with the aid of the Mitrokhin Archives, supplied by Vasily Mitrokhin, The World Was Going Our Way, The KGB and the Battle for the Third World, published by Basic Books. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for asking me.